Welcome to the KSTE Farm Hour. Here's KSTE's Farmer Fred, Fred Hoffman.
Donald Trump has kept his word for California's farmers. He's attempting to shift Delta water away from fish and send it to the farms and cities of the Central Valley. The details are in the just-released U.S. Bureau of Reclamation's Biological Assessment for the Delta. And there's already been blowback. Farmers are filing for bankruptcy in record numbers in the Midwest. But what about California's farmers? How healthy is their financial outlook? We talk with a noted ag economist. You know, for great crops, you need great soil. And there's a research facility here that you need to visit to see some really great soil in action. You think Valentine's Day is a big day for Northern California flower growers? Well, you better think again. We visit one and find out why they're concentrating instead on weddings and special events. All that and more on this week's KSTE Farm Hour. Let's get started. Say what you will about the president, Donald Trump, one thing he has done is keeping his promise to ease the water problems for California's farmers. While campaigning for president back in May of 2016, Donald Trump promised a cheering Fresno crowd that he'd be opening up the water for Central Valley farmers.
And we're going to solve your water problem. You have a water problem that is so insane. It is so ridiculous, where they're taking the water and shoving it out to sea. And I just met with a lot of the farmers who are great people, and they're saying, we don't even understand it. They don't understand. Nobody understands it. And I've heard this from other friends of mine in California, where they have farms up here, and they don't get water. I said, oh, that's too bad. Is it a drought? No, we have plenty of water. I said, what's wrong? Well, we shove it out to sea. And I said, why? And nobody even knows why. And the environmentalists don't know why. Now, they're trying to protect a certain kind of 3-inch fish. But... No, think of it. So nobody even knows why. And by the way, the environmentalists don't know why.
And as soon as he took office, he came through for California's farmers. One of his first actions in 2017 was to set in motion an easing of the very restrictive Waters of the United States rules. Call them Byzantine or Kafkaesque. They were a compendium of fungible regulations regarding so-called navigable waters that were on private property, confounding and angering California's farmers when it came to what they could or couldn't do with their own land or face some very hefty fines. Then Trump took one of the most aggressive steps to date to fulfill his promise to that crowd in Fresno. He proposed to relax environmental regulations governing how water is shared between fish and human uses throughout the Central Valley. And that brings us to this week and the release of the 871-page biological assessment document from the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. It's designed to maximize water supplies and deliveries while maintaining protections for fish. Much of it involves changes in water releases due to temperature requirements for migrating fish, salinity levels in the Delta, and reverse flows. Farm groups happen to like this report. Mike Wade is the executive director of the California Farm Water Coalition. According to the water newsletter, Maven's Notebook, Wade says the current outdated biological opinions have been plagued with operational problems that experts determined were largely ineffective at helping the endangered fish that they were intended to help. Wayne says the operations analyzed in the new biological assessment are intended to improve the conditions for fish and wildlife and the Delta habitat. But on the other side of the ledger is the Golden Gate Salmon Association. They represent the $14 billion California fishing industry. The group secretary, Dick Poole, said that this Bureau of Reclamation report represents a blatant water grab that threatens thousands of fishing jobs and families in California. For the administration to claim that the giant federal water project, which includes the massive diversion pumps in the Delta, can run at full bore and not harm salmon is simply not credible. Where will it all end up? Oh, in court. Expect a massive payday for lawyers.
Some farmers might argue this next statement about the new farm bill, but from one person's viewpoint anyway.
Dairy was the commodity that fared best in the farm bill.
And why?
Because it needed to.
Alan Bierga with the National Milk Producers Federation telling a farm bill forum in Washington this week, dairy operators, especially small and mid-sized ones, have been facing bigger financial problems than farmers in other ag sectors. The margin protection program in the 2014 farm bill did not help as expected. Farmers said it cost too much for what it provided. Now, the farm bill changes the name to...
The Dairy Integrity Margin Coverage Program.
And provides for
more affordable, comprehensive coverage for small producers, while at the same time giving large producers a potentially meaningful level of coverage that would be attracted to them.
Alan Bjerga says the new program should help many dairy operators, but dairies are failing at a rapid rate, so he says the program needs to be implemented quickly. And the USDA man in charge of Farm Bill implementation, Deputy Secretary Steve Sinski, says
that's a top priority.
In Washington, Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Farmers and ranchers across the nation are eagerly awaiting the implementation of the next Farm Bill. The American Farm Bureau Federation's Chad Smith has the details.
Grassroots Farm Bureau members look forward to having a new farm bill. Passed late last year, the bill will help guide farmers through tough economic times and provide necessary programs. At the 2019 AFBF Annual Convention and Idea Ag Trade Show earlier this month, Andrew Walmsley, AFBF Congressional Relations Director, said Farm Bureau members applaud passage of the farm bill.
It was a huge success to get the farm bill done. Now we're waiting on implementation. We've got the issue around the border wall. It's been an opportunity to catch our breath and looking forward to working with USDA to implement the 2018 Farm Bill.
Walmsley says AFBF will partner with USDA to implement the Farm Bill.
The work's not done. Working as a partner with USDA to implement it, how we understand the bill, how we think the committees wrote the bill, they're always a great partner with Secretary Perdue.
He says Farm Bureau will provide updates on the Farm Bill's implementation. Those updates can be found at www.fb.org/market-intel.
One thing for members, we're doing a title by title through our Market Intel program where members can go in, get a little bit more information. And obviously, we'll be updating that as implementation hopefully kicks off soon.
Chad Smith, Washington.
Valentine's Day coming up next Thursday, and you might think that flower growers would be very, very busy right now. Actually, with the rise in imports, many rose growers are looking at other markets. Recently, the California Farm Bureau Federation talked with Chris Nevy of Nevy Brothers in Petaluma. They, among other flower growers across California, are instead concentrating on servicing the wedding market and other special events.
I'm Chris Nevy. I'm from Nevy Brothers. We're here in Petaluma, where our main growing facility is in Sonoma County. We specialize in hybrid tea roses, spray roses, and garden style roses for the wholesale trade, floral designers, and independent grocery stores. We're coming up now on Valentine's Day, which is not a very big holiday for us anymore like it was in the past. The import rose pressure in reds and just the overall flower sales for that time period really don't make it advantageous to grow a lot of red roses. And so we've slowly changed over from being primarily red roses in, say, the mid-90s, being 75% red roses to probably only 10% red roses. It's too hard to depend on Valentine's Day as a big center holiday to provide, you know, you with all your sales that you need for that time period. We're more diversified in all the different types of flowers that we grow, and we're more constant because of it.
If they're not coming from the United States, where are those Valentine's Day flowers coming from? From South America, from Colombia in particular. They're the world's second biggest flower exporter, and the United States imports 80% of the flowers. They produce so many flowers, it takes 65 jumbo jets to transfer them from Colombia to the United States.
All of a sudden, we're past the halfway point on the Western wet season. And if you look at the very broad picture, we do see that season-to-date precipitation, October through January, is actually very close or even above normal in most river basins.
In fact, how USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey might describe the overall state of the Western Mountain snowpack season going into its second half is,
you average it all out, it has been, well, pretty much average. We've seen very close to average numbers.
With perhaps the prime example of this average state from a snowpack perspective coming from the Golden State.
You look at the Sierra Nevada snowpack, which is so important for the California water supply situation. Whether you look at the northern, the central, or the southern Sierra Nevada, we are within a few percentage points of normal for the end of January. 100% of average in the north, 102% in the central Sierra Nevada, 97% in the south. Throw it all together, we've got 17 inches of liquid trapped in the snowpack in the Sierra Nevada. That is exactly average for the end of January.
Rippey adds that, however, there are pockets of concern from a water supply perspective in the West. One example?
The Pacific Northwest has had a lot of warm storm systems to this point. So even though precipitation is average, the snowpack in the Cascades is below average.
With reservoirs in Washington State and Oregon currently at below average water storage. Also in terms of snowpack water equivalency,
the only area that's significantly below average at this time is southern Idaho. There is a pocket there that encompasses parts of the Snake River Plain and some of the mountains surrounding that plain that are running 50 to 75% of average for the season. But almost every other basin is at least 3/4 of average. And then as you move into the southern part of the Intermountain West, the central and southern Rockies, we see a lot of basins in the 110 to 125% of average range.
Yet moving to the southernmost regions of the West, the mountain basins of Arizona and New Mexico.
It's just been a little bit too warm to accumulate snowpack. That's kind of a problem we've been seeing a lot in recent years. We're just not getting snow that sticks around in some of our southernmost basins.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Take the KSTE Farm Hour with you wherever you go. It's available at KSTE.com or the iHeartRadio app in streaming mode, or you can download it from your favorite third-party podcast aggregator such as iTunes. A recent article in the Wall Street Journal highlighted the economic plight of farmers in the Midwest. Throughout that region, U.S. farmers are filing for Chapter 12 bankruptcy protection at levels not seen for at least a decade. For example, the states of Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin had double the bankruptcies in 2018 compared with 2008. In states from North Dakota to Arkansas, bankruptcies swelled 96%. The year-to-year change in Midwest bankruptcy filings has soared 45%. Meanwhile, here in the West, California and six other Western states have seen a decline in bankruptcy filings of 41%. Why the big difference? We're talking with John Newton. He's the chief economist for the American Farm Bureau Federation. And John, what accounts for this difference?
If you look at just California agriculture, it's so much more diverse than the Midwest. When you think about Illinois, Iowa, you know, Iowa has a lot of hog operations, a lot of poultry egg laying facilities, but probably 60% of the land area in Iowa and Illinois is in corn and soybean production. And you look at what those prices have done in recent years. I mean, they're coming off of a record high price environment in 2012. The only thing that's really helped some of those guys is that they've had really fantastic yields. So if they've got the economies of scale, they can, you know, spread their costs around more acres. But overall, the pricing for those corn and soybean and wheat to some extent are a lot lower than they used to be. And I think that's what's driving bankruptcies higher in the Midwest. And you think about upper Midwest, you got a lot of dairies, Northeast, a lot of dairy, and you're seeing a pretty significant exodus of dairy farms as well.
Are the tariff battles playing any part of this?
You know, it's a combination of factors. Where you're looking at, you know, net farm income has been 50% lower than what it was in 2013 for five straight years. And so I think what happened is folks have burned through cash. They've gotten creative in ways to cut costs and be more efficient. You know, they've had to take out, you know, more debt, more lines of credit, and at some point in time kind of run out of options. And that's where Chapter 12 is a bankruptcy option for farmers and ranchers that allows them to repay that debt on a seasonal basis, really reflecting the cyclical nature of agricultural harvesting and marketing.
Certainly the California farming situation has a lot more diversity than that in the Midwest. Would it also be a case of many of the crops we grow here are high value crops, especially the nut crops, pistachios, almonds, and walnuts?
Without a doubt. But many of the commodities across all of U.S. agriculture have seen price pressure downward in recent years. You think profitability on almonds is not what it was several years ago. California is the largest dairy state. Milk prices there in California have been depressed for a number of years. I think it's the diversity and the high value crops, especially the fruit and vegetables, that have led to a decrease in the bankruptcies there in California. California bankruptcies in 2018, there were 18 filings. That's down from 27 filings in 2017. One of the other things to think about with Chapter 12 is there's a debt limit. So if you have a debt level over $4.2 million, you cannot qualify for Chapter 12 bankruptcy. So while it might be a small subset of farms across the country that have debt levels higher than that, it's gonna be some operations that are larger in scale, maybe have a lot of real estate debt, maybe producing some high-value commodities that may see themselves with debt levels that prevent them from using Chapter 12, and then they have to visit other options like Chapter 11, Chapter 7, for example.
Yeah, you mentioned land value, and with increasing land values here in California, obviously that would give farmers here a bit more equity to work with when it comes to securing loans.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's one of the things. Agricultural land values have been pacing pretty well with inflation. I mean, total agricultural asset values in 2018 were over $3 trillion. Compare that to the 80s when it was less than $775 billion. So it's a much different balance sheet, farm financial balance sheet today than what we saw, you know, 30 years ago. But certainly we're starting to see some cracks, the bankruptcies elevating in some of these areas that have more price exposure to this downturn in commodity prices is one key piece of evidence.
Chapter 12 filings are really geared for farming, fishing, and those with a lot of seasonal income, is it? Explain a little bit about Chapter 12 for those who don't know.
Yeah, so Chapter 12, again, provides that flexibility to make a repayment schedule seasonally. And for family farmers, you have to have a debt level that's less than about $4.1-4.2 million. That number does get adjusted for inflation. The fishery side has a smaller debt level of around $2 million, I believe. But it's the flexibility to repay seasonally that really makes Chapter 12 a good option for folks that are considering bankruptcy for their business.
And when it comes to tracking these numbers, I would imagine Chapter 12 is an easier mark to follow versus Chapter 11 or Chapter 7.
Well, all the U.S. courts does report, you know, the bankruptcy filings by chapter, by district, which is then broken out by state. They do that on a quarterly and annual basis. The challenge is how do you really get into it and know if that was a wheat farmer or, you know, a diversified, you know, fruit and vegetable operation or a dairy operation. There's no way to really tease that out of the information from the U.S. courts to really get that level of detail. You almost have to go to the district courts and look at the individual case statistics.
I know your outlook for the country is there's going to be more pressure on farmers regarding debt. Can you break out California in particular? What is the economic future for California's farms?
Well, I think, you know, you look, you know, some of the big commodities that are produced there in the state of California have faced some significant headwinds. You think about nuts, for example. We export a lot of those products, and they're facing some tariffs. Some of their larger markets, you think about dairy products facing tariffs, both Canada, Mexico, and China. A lot of the dairy that's exported is exported, you know, off the western coast, out of the Pacific Northwest, and out of California to Asia. So, you know, there's certainly some uncertainties in California as well as the rest of the country in farming and ranching. Add to it the regulatory situation that farmers find themselves in, the uncertainty around immigration. It's going to be a very challenging environment in 2019. I think we could go a long way to turning around farm income if we can come to some sort of resolution on agricultural trade.
And for California farming in particular, the wild card is always water. Will they have enough?
You're exactly right. I think when Mother Nature's your business partner, as she is in agriculture, you know, you never know what risks may lie ahead of you.
John Newton is the chief economist for the American Farm Bureau Federation. John, thanks for a few minutes of your time.
You got it. Thanks for having me on.
What famous American said nothing could be said to be certain except death and taxes? Well, we'll tell you the answer in a minute. But indeed, traditionally, death and taxes have been linked together in the form of estate taxes. But the tax law, as President Trump said when he signed it back in December 2017,
it makes the vast majority of family farms and small businesses exempt from the estate tax.
Although one expert says under the old law, very few people were subject to the estate tax. This from Iowa State University tax expert Christine Tigran. Under the previous law, you could die owning property worth up to $5.6 million and still not owe federal estate tax. Under the new law that we're filing now for 2018 earnings,
you can die with $11.2 million in property and your estate will not owe any estate tax on that amount.
So as Tigran says,
it's going to pretty much eliminate the concern about estate tax.
Now back to the question, who said nothing could be said to be certain but death and taxes? It was Benjamin Franklin. In Washington, Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Do you know where the most visited agricultural research field is in California? Well, I'll tell you. It's in Five Points, and it's the NRI Project, the National Research Initiative. The project compares plots that have been managed for more than 20 years in an annual rotation of cotton, processing tomatoes, and more recently, sorghum, garbanzos, and melons under four different treatments, no-till plus cover crops, no-till with no cover crops, conventionally tilled with cover crops, and conventionally tilled without cover crops. Much of the project is overseen by specialist Jeff Mitchell with UC Cooperative Extension. He says this site is a very long-term example of exactly what implementation of a small set of soil care or soil health principles really means for soil function and management. Something like 20 peer-reviewed scientific articles have been published based on work done at that study field. You want to see it? It's open every Friday morning. The NRI project is located at the University of California's Westside Research and Extension Center at 17353 West Oakland Avenue in Five Points. Where's Five Points, you ask? It's located northwest of Visalia, about halfway between Highways 99 and 5. Mitchell promises to be out there every Friday morning from February 15th through June 26th. A very diverse and large group of farmers, consultants, public agencies, and private sector folks participated in a highly successful training session on the benefits of soil management for farming systems down in Five Points recently. It was an overflow crowd. Farmers, researchers were there. So was Jeff Mitchell. Jeff Mitchell is a Cooperative Extension cropping systems specialist out of the Kearney Ag Research and Extension Center. And Jeff, there were some very interesting comments and displays and knowledge shared at that workshop recently down in Five Points, not the least of which that really pinpointed the reasons why there should be more no-till farming and cover cropping, and a lot of good reasons to do that with actual farmers showing their actual results.
Fred, you're absolutely right. It was really a nice event. We had an overflow crowd of nearly 200 people there, and the program that we provided had that mix of farmers, very experienced farmers from throughout the Central Valley, and also researchers that were able to showcase a very long-term project that has been evaluating these practices, the reduced disturbance, no-till planting system, plus the use of off-season winter cover crops. And together, the program, I think, really was successful in distilling three main outcomes or three main conclusions. First of all, that yes, no-till is and has been shown to be a viable option for valley farms in a number of crops, including, I'd say, sorghum, beans. The folks at the field, they had a chance to observe those two crops under no-till and standard tillage production techniques right before their eyes there. And we've had good yields with no-till over the last 3 or 4 years for the sorghum and beans there. So the people were able to see that up close and personal. Another outcome, when this came from both the research and the farmers, is the dedicated attention to improving soil biology, if you will. Can you provide more feed material through carbon, nitrogen inputs, through cover crops and compost that feeds and sustains that soil life, the soil biology? And what kinds of benefits can you expect to get from that in terms of fertility cycling, in terms of water retention, water infiltration, water cycling, and availability to crops? And then lastly, I think, was the fact that these systems really now, again, coming from a lot of the farmer presenters on the program, as well as our own research experience, that they're economically important and they're yielding the good quality crops, they're yielding profitable yields, and the systems now are making sense in terms from a number of angles. So that's what we tried to showcase in the training event last week.
So the trial has basically four farming systems side by side at your research facility. It's a 320-acre facility. You've got a conventional system with annual soil tillage and no cover crops. Then you have one with conservation agriculture with no tilling whatsoever and annual winter cover crops. You've got no-till without the cover crop, and you have conventional tilling with a cover crop. So you have four of those. And you mentioned about water savings. Tell us about the difference in the water holding capacity of a conventional system versus the one with conservation agriculture.
Very good. All right. One of the demonstrations we had there, a couple of them, first of all, was the stability of the soil aggregates, how well the soil stays together and maintains porosity to allow water to infiltrate during those rare winter times when we do get rain down here. It's very dramatic. Now, we've seen this for a number of training events that we've had. The no-till with cover crop system, particularly its aggregate stability, the soil aggregation, is just dramatically increased relative to the standard till without cover crops. So by adding organic matter and those glues that that keep the soil aggregated and held together are very important, and that's one thing that, that works in favor of increasing water relations in the soil. The other dimension of no-tillage that has impacts and relevance for water and water conservation is that when you reduce disturbance, when you reduce tillage and you keep a mulch, a surface mulch that comes from past crop residues and cover crop residues, you reduce that soil temperature, first of all, dramatically. That can be 20 or more degrees on hot summer days. But you also not only cool the soil, but you reduce the amount of water that gets evaporated from that soil surface. And that's something we've quantified now in a number of studies down here. It's not huge, but we've shown that if you have reduced disturbance, no-till systems with the surface mulch, that you can actually reduce during a typical summer evapotranspiration period the soil water evaporation loss by about 15%. So that's the equivalent of 4 or 5 inches during a normal summer cropping period. So that's significant, and that's another potential benefit of these alternative production systems that we've now gotten some data on.
And it's kind of, there's a great other advantage to that water as well, besides less evaporation. Didn't your experiments with cover crops also show more water infiltration deeper into the soil?
Yeah, that's kind of an ongoing thing. And we've been doing that now at a number of farm sites and orchards as well through the valley up all the way up northern California, in the North Sacramento Valley, all the way down here to the Five Points area. But yeah, looking at those trade-offs that are involved with inserting or growing that winter cover crop during that winter window from, let's say, November through the end of February, when there's typically not cropping going on and the fields are normally bare or fallow, can you plant in a deliberate cover crop, gain advantage in terms of capturing carbon, plant biomass, and sunlight energy through photosynthesis into plant biomass and be feeding the soil with carbon and maybe, if it's a legume, atmospherically fixed nitrogen that's going to be in the root nodules and improve the carbon and nitrogen in those systems. But what are the trade-offs of doing that with respect to water? And what we've been doing the last couple of years is really trying to, in a very comprehensive way, quantify those trade-offs in terms of how much water, you know, is maybe lost through transpiration of that cover crop during that period. But as you point out, can there be benefits of improved or increased infiltration because of improvements in the soil structure and also from, not having the winter raindrops, the pressure that they have when they hit the soil surface in destroying and dispersing that soil and creating crust and surface sealing there. So there are a lot of things going on at the same time, but you're right. What we're trying to do is assess the overall trade-offs of these kinds of alternatives.
We're talking with Dr. Jeff Mitchell. He's a cooperative extension cropping systems specialist with the University of California. He's based down at the Kearney Agricultural Research and Extension Center. And recently they hosted a soil management training that showed at their research center the benefits of no-till and cover cropping on typical farm soils that included growing sorghum and beans. I love the quote from Scott Park, the farmer from Meridian, who said, "When I step on a field and it feels like a road, something is wrong. But if it feels like a marshmallow or sponge, that's a good thing."
I agree. I think that was something. Scott Park, by the way, is a farmer, a very experienced farmer up in Meridian, California. And he was the kickoff speaker on the program down here last week. And And he's exactly right. And he has seen that and experienced that himself. And I dare say that so have we, that there are one of the other demonstrations we had at the Five Points training event was we tried to show and brought people out to look at the soil profile in soil pits that were, you know, excavated down to about 4 feet. And there were only modest differences that we could see. But that sponginess or that softness of the soil is something that we now, after pretty near 18 years of doing no-till in some of these systems down here, there are some very dramatic soil physical changes in the surface few inches that are, dare I say, pretty remarkable. That and we've gotten good data on that too. But I agree that Scott is on to something on that observation.
One of the demonstrations you had too was on the tabletop, 4-quart jars filled with what a lot of people may remember back from high school or college as a soil experiment to determine if it's sand, silt, or clay. And that is, you put a soil sample in a quart jar of water, a little bit of soap, and let it sit for a while, and the soil will separate into different layers. And you had the conventional soil, and that's probably what most people would think of as being healthy soil because it's kind of cloudy and it's separated. You see the sand at the bottom, the silt sort of giving a cloudy look, and the clay as well. But the no-till cover crop soil sample in that jar of water was like a big clump at the top, and the water was clear. And people may look at that and say, well, that has to be wrong. It's the cloudy one's the right one.
No, you're right. I mean, your description there is spot on there. And since the training event, I've gotten several emails of people. They wanted to make sure that they understood exactly that photograph or that process that they witnessed live on the training day there. But you're exactly right. What we have now seen, and we've measured this in over a number of recent years there, is that the standard till, the soil that's just conventionally managed with fairly intensive tillage in between crops, when it is exposed to water, it tends to fall apart. It disperses and it doesn't hold together. Whereas now the no-till with cover crop system, the stability again of those aggregates, that aggregate or that little chunk of soil, imagine a 2-inch, you know, diameter chunk of soil that we put in water, both from no-till and cover crop and also the standard till without cover crop, the no-till with cover crop soil remained intact. It remained solid and as an aggregate. And it also, at the end of another demonstration we had was to show water infiltration with a rainfall simulator. And what was very dramatic was the standard till without cover crop system, water quickly ran off the surface of the soil tray, and it didn't infiltrate very deep into that 3 or 4 inch tray there. Whereas in the no-till with cover crop system, not only was there less runoff from the surface, but there was also greater infiltration to depth through the soil profile. So again, these are very, you know, most people might say, well, they're small, the subtle kinds of changes, but they can really matter in terms of capturing rainfall in the wintertime, making sure that it doesn't go into, you know, to the riverways and with sediment and everything, and make sure it stays and remains captured in that field there. These can be really important strategies for, you know, retaining water in a farm field there. And I think it's very important that we understand these kinds of processes. I do want to just reiterate that the no-till and the emphasis on soil biology, these conclusions or these outcomes have only come from lots and lots of time, lots of effort. In fact, some of the farmers mentioned that improving soil quality or soil health isn't going to happen instantaneously. It takes time and it takes dedicated, concerted management that is going to allow one to get to that ever there. But these things are now possible. There are farmers, and our own research has shown and seen benefits of deliberate emphasis on reduced disturbance and also on soil biology. And these are the main outcomes, I think, that come from that training event. The last thing I'll throw in for your your listeners and for your audience, Fred, is that one of the things that we've quantified now over many, many years is that even with very, very minimal, very modest inputs of water to get a winter cover crop going, and by that I mean 1 or 2 inches just to get the cover crop seed growing in the fall, and then relying on winter rainfall, that over about 16 years we've captured about 27 tons of organic matter in standing cover crop biomass, and about 7 or so tons of that is in carbon, the form of the carbon molecule. And not all of that ends up going into the soil, but over time, that is providing more carbon that can be stored and provide benefits into soil and the functions of the soil there. So with very modest trade-offs in terms of water, and that's what part of our research is looking at, there can be many, many benefits that could come out of that. So it's going to be a challenge to apply a lot of this, but there are people that are trying to do that right now.
And if people want more information about this, they can visit the CASI website. CASI stands for Conservation Agriculture Systems Innovation, and their website is casi.ucanr.edu. Or you could just do an internet search of the phrase CASI, CASI, and the UC link will pop up, and you can get a lot more information about no-till and about cover crops and a lot more. Jeff Mitchell, Cooperative Extension Cropping Systems Specialist down at the Kearney Ag Research and Extension Center. This is exciting stuff. Thank you for your time today.
Fred, I want to thank you very much, and we appreciate the chance to share with folks.
USDA's latest edition of its annual America's Diverse Family Farms Report is now out.
America's Diverse Family Farms Report is an overview of the 2 million U.S. farms and describes the characteristics of the many types of farms within the U.S.
And Agriculture Department economic researcher Chris Byrne says the general summary of findings in the 2018 edition of this report reveal
98% of U.S. farms are family farms, and they account for 87% of farm production.
Also, small farms make up 89% of total farm count and operate half of farmland in the U.S. Another finding, farm households in general are neither low income or low wealth.
About 59% of farm households receive an income that was at or above the median for all U.S. households in 2017.
This year's America's Diverse Family Farms Report also studied the specific category of farm production under contract.
The agreement typically between a farmer and some intermediary like a processor that governs the quantity, the price, and the outlet for a particular commodity. And this is a tool that farmers can use to lower their risk for price risk and revenue. So it helps them lock in a price for their product.
So based on the research results,
we found that about 1/3 of all agricultural production occurs under contract in 2017.
Which Burns notes is about the same percentage as 20 years ago. However, there are some slight and notable differences among different commodities.
So for example, tobacco has gone from almost no production under contract to about 90% of tobacco is produced under contract in 2017. And that had to do with changes in the tobacco industry, the manufacturers moving from cash auction to production contracts for tobacco. We also saw large changes in hog production. So hog processors wanted to have more control over the quality of the hog meat and have increased their use of contracts as well.
The size of family farms, under contracts or not, show a connection with what these farms grow and produce.
For example, large-scale family farms account for over 2/3 of dairy production and over half of high-value crops like fruits and vegetables, tree nuts, things such as that. While mid-size and large-scale family farms dominate the cotton production, they made up 85% of that in 2017. Together, mid-size and large-scale family farms accounted for over 1/3 of total cash grain and oilseed production. Small farms were responsible for over half of hay and poultry production.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Visitors to farmers markets are used to seeing some unusual fruit crosses in the summertime. Pluots, apriums, pluaries, things like that. But even in the wintertime, there are some interesting crosses involving citrus. At a recent Auburn Farmers Market, the placer-grown people talked with Bob from Snow's Citrus, and he talked about the latest and greatest.
Bob from Snow's here. And what we have today at the market is a Eustace Limequat. It's a cross between a kumquat and a lime. So traditionally with a kumquat, you would eat the peel and not the fruit inside because the peel's really sweet. People that like kumquats pop the whole thing in their mouth. So now take a lime, and put those characteristics in a lime. So it's a cross between a kumquat and a lime once again. So you can eat it whole or you can just eat the peel. Most customers use it just like a mini lime. But it's just something unique that we do that you don't find too often. So come on by the market and see us. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the KSTE Farm Hour. Heard every Sunday from noon until 1 p.m. Pacific Time. And available anytime as a podcast. Download it at KSTE.com.